Captain Barrow, Reel One. Can you tell me, please, how you first came to know and be involved in the Falklands crisis?
Yes, I was captain of HMS Glamorgan in 1982 and had been in command of the ship for the previous 18 months. And in the early months of 1982, we were in Portsmouth Dockyard and therefore in close touch with what was going on in the UK media, and it became apparent through reading the ordinary newspapers, just like any other person could have done, that all was not well in the South Atlantic. And one also had from time to time buzzes from one's friends in the Ministry of Defence or in naval circles more closely connected with the what we call the foreign affairs situation than most civilians, and certainly than I was. And therefore, when we sailed from the UK on the 17th of March 1982 on the annual spring exercise, spring train, in company with a lot of other ships from the UK, I wasn't expecting to go to the South Atlantic, but I did expect that while we were away, we would know more about what was going on down there. When we sailed from Portsmouth, we were in company with a number of ships under the command of Admiral Sandy Woodward, who was a very good friend of mine. We joined the Navy together some 40 years before, so I knew him very well indeed. And at this stage, he was not in my ship. He was flying his flag in the Antrim. And the plan was that while we were in Gibraltar, I was to embark the Commander-in-Chief fleet in my ship, Admiral Sir John Fieldhouse. This was for a weekend of port activities in Gibraltar, and subsequently to host the Admiral on board whilst he made visits to individual ships at sea during phase two of spring train. While Admiral Fieldhouse was on board, and I remember well when he came on board on the Thursday evening when we got into Gibraltar, we got a continuous flow through my communication system of signals both directly from the Ministry of Defence and the Foreign Office, but also from his own headquarters at Northwood, forwarded on by his Chief of Staff, Admiral Sir David Halifax, which made it quite clear to me, because I was privileged to read these signals as his flag captain at that time, that things were brewing up in the South Atlantic.
Could you, at this stage, to interrupt the narrative, tell me a bit about your own ship and its personnel and how experienced they were and how much confidence you had in them at this very early stage?
Yes, as I had already said, I had been in command of the ship since October 1980, when the ship had just, or was just, emerging from a three-year refit to update the missile system, the communications, and certain other aspects of the equipment. I was fortunate, therefore, in taking over not only a newly refitted ship, but also a new ship's company. And I did, therefore, know my ship's company pretty well by the time we got to March 1982. We had been together for about 16 months, and although there had been changes during that time, the company were predominantly the same one which I had inherited and built up during the preceding year or so. The ship's company were an extremely young one. There was a very large number of them who were in their first sea draft, and the average age of the ship's company was about 19 in the early months of 1982. We had done a workup, and so the ship was fully worked up when we sailed for Gibraltar, because in the previous 4 months we had done a deployment to the Middle East and the Mediterranean, which unfortunately came to a rather earlier end than I anticipated, because I had the unfortunate experience of putting the ship aground in a little place called Bandar Jissa on the coast of the Oman. As a result of that, although we were able operationally to continue our task, it was thought proper to bring us back to UK to repair ourselves. And although this was a disappointment not to be able to complete the deployment to that very interesting part of the world, it was a blessing in disguise, not least because we got home for Christmas, but also because we were immediately available after we'd had two new propellers fitted for Exercise Spring Train, which, as I've already said, eventually turned into Operation Corporate.
How confident at this stage did you feel about the equipment and weapon systems that you were taking to the South Atlantic?
My ship was, by then, although we had just had a midlife refit, getting a bit antiquated in terms of equipment. And in spite of this, though, we had a full fit of equipment, and I did have very high confidence in the mechanical equipment on board, and indeed it never failed me throughout my 2.25 years in command. Some of the sensors were not state-of-the-art by any means, and the radars and computer systems were by now fairly antiquated. However, notwithstanding this, they did perform well, and the only limitations really were in the availability of spare parts, which was something which we found when we got to the South Atlantic in war conditions was very inhibiting on our operational availability.
Were South Atlantic waters ones that you personally were very familiar with?
No, they were not. I had never been to the South Atlantic or that part of it. I had spent a couple of years, 25 years before, in South Africa and the waters around there, but I had never been previously to the south of South America. The nearest I had got to it was in a previous command when I visited Brazil on a couple of occasions, but I had never been to the Falklands nor to the Antarctic.
What about the Argentinian armed forces? Did you personally know much about them?
I knew very little about the Argentinian armed forces. It had never really been of interest to find out, since I personally had already always thought of them as our friends and allies should the need arise. This was particularly pertinent because during the early months of 1982, my ship had been the host ship for one of the Argentinian Type 42 destroyers, which had been doing a workup post-build in Portsmouth. And I became quite friendly with the commanding officer and one or two of the officers of this ship, the Hercules, whilst they were on many occasions lying alongside us in Portsmouth Dockyard during their trials period. I was particularly glad that, as matters transpired, we never actually had to take on the Hercules. I would have found that quite difficult with people I actually knew personally.
At this stage, did you at all reflect on the political justification for intervening in to defend the Falkland Islands, or was your approach simply one of professionalism? I mean, did you believe in the operation politically?
If I take the question the other way around, I mean, professionally, one had no alternative rather than just carry out the orders that we were given, and this we did to the best of our ability. Politically, I think we all had views on this. My own personal view, and that's obviously the one I know best, was that I had no doubt at all that if somebody's real estate, whoever it belongs to, is invaded by another power, then it is reasonable, politically and militarily, to go to the defence of that land against the invaders. There were people on board my ship who perhaps they thought a bit more deeply than I did. Maybe their political views were slightly different. There were one or two who did question this, and it was something which I was at pains to point out, my views anyway, to the ship's company on more than one occasion.
Did they come to you to question whether we should be intervening?
They never came to me formally. We did have some discussions around the hearth in the wardroom, and sometimes when I was chatting to people on the bridge informally, but we never had a formal discussion on the pros and cons of the political decision.
So they thought the Argentinians should just be allowed to take what they wanted?
No, I don't think anybody thought that. What they questioned was the need to intervene militarily. Couldn't we have sorted the thing out by diplomatic means? And my answer to that always was that the military are always there to carry out the wishes of the government of the time if diplomatic means fail.
At this early stage, how optimistic did you feel about the likely success of the operation? Were you worried?
I think in the early stages we were probably quite confident that we could do what we had to do. We had very little indication of as to the actual capabilities of the Argentinian Navy operating some way from their bases, and even less idea as to the capability of the Air Force. I think my main worry was as to whether the Argentinian carrier could play a significant part in the operation, because had she been at sea with her considerably longer range aircraft than we possessed, and furthermore early warning aircraft, which we did not possess at all, they would have played a very major part in the balance of sea power. As far as the balance ashore was concerned, I think I was fairly confident that if we were able to put our troops ashore, whoever those troops may have turned out to be, then in due time we could have beaten them. I think one of the major factors which entered into our minds, and certainly the planning staff with which I was very closely involved, was the matter of weather. The weather in April is acceptable down there. As midsummer approaches, the weather gets worse and worse and worse, and we were very conscious that operating 8,000 miles from home, our ships would suffer from the weather. There would be deterioration in the weapon systems, and probably, certainly, the morale and the well-being of embarked troops particularly.
How confident did you feel about the size of the task force that was being sent down there?
The size of the task force was something which I was closely involved in deciding. We did it on the floor of my cabin with the Commander-in-Chief and Admiral Woodward in those few critical days before we set sail south. We were thinking and planning from really almost ignorance, because the ship, my ship, did not, of course, carry the details of that the lineup, the orbat of the Argentinians, and in fact we hardly had any charts of the area. But it was very clear to us right from the start that although we might have been tempted to take more ships down south, if we did so, partly because of the weather, partly because of the distance, and partly sheer the need of ships, modern ships particularly, to maintain or be maintained by outside forces, that if we took all the ships we wanted to, there wouldn't be any left in the UK or elsewhere to replace us when we got there. So it was a fine balance for the Commander-in-Chief to decide how many ships he wanted to take. There was a damage assessment made in the Ministry of Defence, which I believe, although I never actually saw it, was an assessment that we would probably lose 11 ships in the course of the operation if things went the way the Ministry of Defence planners, who, well, undoubtedly they were pessimistic in their assessment. I think all planners have to be to get the answers right in the end, that we would lose 11 ships. And if you've lost 11 ships from the ones that we took down there initially, there wouldn't have been many of us left. In the event, we lost fewer ships, so I think the assessments were certainly pessimistic, but we were lucky not to lose more.
In deciding which ship should go, were the various qualities of the commanding officers taken into account?
Yes, I think the experience and perceived ability of the commanding officers were a factor, but only one of many factors. One of the most prevalent factors was really the state of maintenance of the individual ships. as well as their weapon fit and perceived operational availability.
Now, if we can pick up the narrative, please, from where I interrupted you, if you can tell me what you recollect as happening to you next.
Well, when we sailed from Gibraltar at the end of the harbour phase of spring train, the plan was to continue with our weapons firings, missile firings, and also to do a minor exercise with the Portuguese Navy. For the first phase, we were, as I've said already, due to have Admiral Fieldhouse on board, and he was going round individual ships, visiting them during the missile firing and other exercises taking place. So we were acting as a base for him and a very small staff he had with him. In the event, in fact, he left us only some 12 hours or so after we sailed from Gibraltar that Monday morning, and we continued with our exercises. We did a couple more missile firings and so on, and we were just then steaming north, and I was the senior officer of a small group going up to join up with some Portuguese forces west of Lisbon. And I think the Portuguese ATC was probably rather surprised when I had to make him a signal at 4 o'clock in the morning for an exercise that was due to start very shortly afterwards, to say, "Very sorry, we can't actually meet you after all. I have got to go south." And I did actually say to him that it will become obvious to you why we've done this when you switch on your radio tomorrow morning. So we then proceeded with all dispatch to join Admiral Woodward, who by then was just south of the Strait of Gibraltar with another group of ships doing a different exercise. And for the next 36 hours, we cross-decked between the ships that were due to go south to the South Atlantic and those that were going back to UK. We, for instance, gave them our practice ammunition, and they gave us some of their real ammunition. And all manner of stores were transferred to and fro, so that the ships going south were as fully topped up of everything they needed, or we thought we might need, as possible. And those going back to UK were denuded of virtually everything that we could take from them. Likewise, we did take steps to augment personnel deficiencies where there were any. Although I must admit, my ship, we weren't missing any critical people. We had actually got two people in the UK, strangely enough, a father and son. Father was there because his wife was very ill, and the son was playing hockey for the Navy. But they were the only two people who actually missed going south with the ship. During this period also, Admiral Woodward decided to transfer his flag as FOF 1 and CTG 317.8 to Glamorgan. I've never really quite known why he did this, why he decided to leave the Antrim and come to Glamorgan. Some people say it was because he had already decided that it should be Antrim who should go to South Georgia later on. Others, and I think including myself, thought, perhaps rather smugly, that he was coming to Glamorgan because he had flown his flag in the ship for about a month out in the Indian Ocean, and his staff and my officers particularly had got on extremely well in the ship. And the other reason probably was that our communications fit was significantly better than the Antrim's, mainly due to our midlife refit, which we had finished some 6-8 months before.
FOF 1 and CGT, did you say?
CTG, Commander Task Group 317.8. He was the task group commander, and we were the people going south. The task force commander was Commander-in-Chief Fleet, Admiral Fieldhouse, back at Northwood. Having done our cross-decking and said goodbye to those going back north, we made our way south to Ascension Island. This wasn't a straight, steady passage by any means, because at this stage the political shuffling backwards and forwards across the Atlantic by General Haig and other diplomatic manoeuvres were taking place to try and convince the Argentinians that we would take military action if they did not remove themselves from the Falklands. Did you?
If you can tell me what happened next, please.
Right. Well, we continued our way south, and the advance group of ships at this stage consisted of Glamorgan with the flag, Antrim, Yarmouth, Broadsword, Brilliant, Arrow, Alacrity, Coventry, Glasgow, Plymouth, and the Royal Fleet Auxiliaries Fort Austin, Resource, Almeda, and Tidespring. Whereas the warships were able to sustain fairly high speeds, particularly as we got closer towards the equator, our speed of advance was, of course, limited by the fleet auxiliaries, since our need to use the tankers to top up. We were urged by the Ministry of Defence to make our best speed south, and this we did whenever we could. So we leapfrogged with the Royal Fleet Auxiliaries and also carried out a number of exercises on our way. We eventually arrived in Ascension on the 11th of April, and at that stage the Ascension Island was being turned into a rather sleepy hollow radio station island with a small airstrip run by one United States Air Force Lieutenant Colonel and Pan Am. About the time we arrived there, the RAF and the RN contingent were flown in, and the Wide Awake, as he was called, the Wide Awake airfield, was activated as a British military base under the command of Captain Bob McQueen, Royal Navy, who was designated the commander of British Forces Ascension. I should at this point perhaps stress the importance of Ascension as the stepping stone from between the UK and the South Atlantic. Not only was it the airhead from which most of our stores and reinforcements and spare parts were flown, but it was also the advance base for tankers and ships on their way out to or on the way back from UK. Whilst we were in Ascension, there were a number of scares. We were told that an Argentinian submarine and then a Russian submarine were possibly lurking around in the vicinity, and so we remained underway for most of our stay there. And on the 14th of April, the Antrim, the Brilliant, the Plymouth, and the Fort Austin were detached from Ascension to South Georgia to carry out their operations down there. And at the same time, Glamorgan proceeded north to meet the Hermes Invincible group, who were coming down at fairly high speed from UK. They arrived in Ascension on the 15th, and by that time we had transferred the staff at sea to the Hermes, where they remained for the rest of Operation Corporate. Perhaps I could just stop here for a moment to relate my experiences of that 11 days while Glamorgan was the flagship of Admiral Woodward. We started with just the advance group of some 8 or 9 ships under our command, or under the Admiral's command, and in the intervening 11 days, the number of ships under command or about to come under command amounted to some 53 ships. This was quite an experience, really, and required quite a bit of planning and certainly extra communications, to which my ship and the staff responded extremely well. What we did on board physically was to convert the Admiral's quarters into a flag ops room from which all the detailed planning and communications were conducted. I moved out into another cabin in the ship and the Admiral moved into mine, and we found that by doing that it gave us space for the enormous amount of signal traffic and paperwork and so on that was required. And we had embarked specially when we left Gibraltar area some additional senior officers, Captain Wallace, another old friend of mine who was Captain D3, happened to be in Gibraltar inspecting one of his flotilla, but he had previously been the captain of the Endurance in the South Atlantic some 3-4 years before, and his knowledge of the area proved particularly useful to Admiral Woodward, and especially in this planning phase. We also had two other captains, Captain Woodhead and Captain Buchanan, who were specially attached to the Admiral as duty captains to give the Admiral a bit of respite during the time when he was not actually awake and on the job. Getting to know those two was particularly useful during that time, although I'd met them both before. I didn't know them well. Buchanan was a submariner and well known to Woodward. Woodhead was an aviator, and both of them were invaluable with their specialist advice.
What had been the changes in atmosphere on board ship as you headed south and reached Ascension Island? Did it change?
Yes, the atmosphere changed to one of excitement, I think, for the young on board especially. For all of us, and I think I can say literally everybody, this was, if it turned out to be, their first experience of war or anything like it. And therefore there was a certain amount of anticipation, excitement, yes, but perhaps a bit uncertain. And I think a lot of people perhaps thought that it was never going to happen, and this was just another rather special exercise laid on by the Admiral and the Captain to hype them up. But as we got further and further south, we listened to the news, and we got extremely good news from the World Service, as well as the signals and things which I saw. I think the ship's company gradually began to realize, and I was at pains to keep them informed, that this probably was going to be the real thing. I think my concern was to make people aware of what we were going to do, and of course we did exercises. We, for instance, practiced wearing gas masks and anti-flash gear and all the other uncomfortable kit that one has to wear or be prepared to wear in wartime or activities. We would practice our damage control in the ship, and of course we did a lot of weapon exercises, although we had to be careful not to use up too much live ammunition at this stage. I think my other concern was not to bring the ship's company to a high state of readiness, or both operationally but also mentally, too early, because I think one knows, with whether you're training a football team or a ship's company, that if you get people hyped up, psyched up too early, then they'll go off the boil. When you want them, they will be past their prime. So this was a bit of a juggling exercise, and I remember discussing with my commander, Commander Gotto, this factor on a number of occasions, as to whether what we should tell them and what we should try and do tomorrow to prepare ourselves further. I think as things turned out, although we didn't quite know at that stage when we were actually going to go into action, by the time we did on the 1st of May, I think we were probably just about at the peak of